Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation, episode 157, recorded June 30th, 2014. Peter Rojas. Triangulation is brought to you by SmartThings, the easiest and most affordable way to create a smart home. Protect and control your home from anywhere with no contracts or monthly fees. For 10% off any home security kit, visit smartthings.com/twit and use the code TWIT10 at checkout. It's time for Triangulation, the show where we interview the smartest and most interesting people in technology. Our guest today is Peter Rojas, the Vice President of Strategy for the AOL Brand Group, but probably best known for founding or co-founding a long list of tech sites, including Gizmodo, Engadget, Joystick, Record Label, and GDGT. Welcome, Peter Rojas.
Hey, thanks for having me on. I'm not sure I reached the threshold for being one of the smartest people in tech, but I'm still excited to be here.
You absolutely are. You're also one of the most humble, we appreciate that. Now, I mentioned the last in my list of sites that you've co-founded or founded as GDGT. I know that one way to pronounce it is just Gadget. The other one is GDGT. I personally prefer GDGT.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, simply because Gadget is a little ambiguous and it's not really clear what you're talking about, but GDGT. Plus, it's fun to say. GDGT.
Yeah, we kind of went back and forth on that, and I preferred GDGT. Ryan Block, who's my co-founder, preferred Gadget, but we kind of felt like, at least when we were getting started, that it was a little confusing to have to go from Engadget then to Gadget and have it not spelled G-A-D-G-E-T, which we did try to buy that domain, and it was something like $1.7 million, and we decided not to go down that route. But we kind of figured, as long as you got to where you were going or found the right place, we didn't really care what you called it.
Now, GDGT has now been folded into Engadget proper. And so this is something that people need to be clear about. And I want to talk about GDGT and where it's at now. But currently, how heavily used are the GDGT features on the new Engadget site? Is it still a popular site? Is it still an active community there?
Yeah, it still gets a bunch of usage, and we've basically been able to sort of combine the platform that we built with Gadget or GDGT into the Engadget site. There's still a lot of work that we need to do to fully integrate things. There's not like a single user account across if you want to comment or if you want to use the Gadget features, and that has to do with the fact that we really still have two CMSs in the back end there, but we managed to, and I give Ryan and his, product team a lot of credit here for doing a great job of sort of making it as seamless as could be done, under the circumstances. And so we have all the product pages and forums and review, tools and, product research tools and things like that. And that stuff is getting a ton of usage and went up after sort of having this fire hose of Engadget users being sort of piped into it.
Yeah. So just to be clear so that people aren't confused about all the things we're talking about now, one of the sites you founded was Engadget. Later on, you co-founded with Ryan Block. You also co-founded with Ryan Block GDGT. And then later on, these were folded together, and these were all under the AOL umbrella, and both you and Ryan Block are executives at AOL, essentially, right?
Yeah. So Ryan actually didn't found Engadget with me. He joined about 3 months after we started.
Okay.
But he's practically a co-founder, for all intents and purposes. Engadget is basically a Gadget blog. And what we did with Gadget was we built more of a product database with a set of features on top of it. And one was that we aggregated reviews from across the web, a little bit like a Rotten Tomatoes or, what's the other one for games that's out there? Metacritic. And then we built, tools for doing price comparison and price tracking and stuff like that. And then ways for, if you were interested, sort of more of an enthusiast, you could build a profile of all the gadgets that you owned or had or wanted. So that was sort of more for the power users or the really enthusiast users. And, it was very complimentary to what Engadget did. Engadget sort of was very, very editorially driven, traditional sort of publication. Whereas what we built with Gadget was more of, there wasn't really an editor behind any of it. It was sort of us aggregating data and building sort of like a social commerce platform across, I think we had something like 35 or 36,000 products in the database when we were acquired last year.
It was a pretty radical vision for a Gadget site. And would you call it a social network? I know there was a social component and you were trying to gather a community around Gadget enthusiasm. Was that a social network?
I don't know what you would say would be the threshold for something being a social network, because I think that, the idea, the way we felt at the time when we started working on this, I guess, which was 2008, was that everything was going to have some sort of community or social component to it. And so whether you were a full-fledged social network or whether you were, the New York Times, you should have, you should build community into what you're doing. And so what we thought was we wanted to have a place where the people that were sort of the most enthusiastic, the most knowledgeable about gadgets could come and hang out with each other, share their passion, share their expertise, their knowledge. There was, Q&A, forums, users could contribute their own reviews of stuff, but also make that data, that that information or knowledge usable by a more general population of people who might never, we're probably never going to join and sign up for the site, but would find it really useful to be able to see, what are the most knowledgeable and passionate people about gadgets say about this gadget.
Yeah, really interesting site, and it's been interesting to see its evolution. Now, right now, you're the vice president of strategy for the AOL Brand Group. What is that exactly? What's your average day like? What do you do all day?
Well, besides talking to people like you, so the Brand Group is sort of all the media businesses at AOL. So TechCrunch, Engadget, Joystick, Autoblog, AOL.com, which is a huge, huge, huge property still. MapQuest, there's like a few dozen sort of media properties under it. Huffington Post sort of sits alongside this sort of business unit that I'm part of. But it all rolls up to the bigger AOL Corporation as one sort of mega division, I guess. Mm-hmm. But and so what I do is I work with Susan Lyne, who's the CEO of the Brand Group, and she's amazing. She used to run ABC, so she's the person who greenlit Desperate Housewives and Lost. She ran Guilt Group. She ran Martha Stewart. Martha Stewart was in jail. So she's, super smart, really seasoned executive, really knows the media business, really passionate about technology and new platforms. And, when she came on a few weeks after we were acquired, she asked if I would kind of step up and help help her crafting product and media and content strategy. And so I've been doing that, which is, working with the different brands that we have to make sure that we're, for example, a good example would be make the transition to mobile. I think that AOL has been sort of focused on desktop as sort of a media company. And so helping us figure out what does it mean to be a mobile focused media company. And we have a ton of work to do there. So I've been working on some stuff like that. And one example of a product that came out of that strategy, I guess, was when we did Engadget Mini for CES. And so we built this sort of app where you could in real time get updates from CES from the Engadget editors. And we got something like 150,000 downloads in the first week during CES, and the editors of Engadget posted something like 1,100 or 1,200 updates during the course of the 6 or 7 days of CES. And it was, it would be stuff like Vines and Instagrams from the show floor. It'd be all the headlines, not just from Engadget, but from anywhere that was, posting interesting stuff, videos, tweets from the editors and from other people that are, there at CES. So it was sort of this, kind of interesting snackable real-time experience of CES that kind of filtered through the eyes of the editors of Engadget. And so, we're pretty excited about that, and I'm helping kind of take that platform behind that, which is sort of this really lightweight real-time microblogging platform that we built called Mini, and helping extend that to other brands here at AOL that might want it. And we're doing for the World Cup, we did a version of it for that where we're sort of live blogging the World Cup, and that's called AOL App Brazil. If anybody's interested in downloading it, and you kind of get like the same kind of feed of real-time updates. If you want, a notification every time a goal is scored, you can get that. And there's definitely been some games where my phone keeps like buzzing constantly because people keep scoring goals, which is kind of exciting. And so after I helped kind of do that app or that platform in January, Luke Beattie, who was one of the founders of Associated Content, which he sold to AOL a few years ago, to Yahoo a few years ago, came to AOL as Susan Lyne's head of product, as head of product for the brand group. And he asked me if I would help run sort of like an experimental products group where we take things like that and, you know, try to build more of them. So I'm actually working on a couple more, I would say, sort of experimental mobile apps, which hopefully will be out before between now and the end of the year. So doing like a mix of building new stuff and then helping like the rest of the group figure out like what new things we should be doing and what new challenges we need to be aware of.
Now, of course, in a company like that where you've got multiple brands and the company itself has its Uber brand, you always have to make decisions about which brand to emphasize. So, for example, you mentioned the use of the Engadget brand for this mini site. You mentioned the use of the AOL brand for the World Cup site. That's always a tricky thing, isn't it? Because on the one hand, you've got these hot brands that have a lot of sort of street cred. And then you've got the big AOL brand, which kind of like is associated with, I don't know, it's been around for so long, and it's associated with, as you mentioned, the desktop rather than mobile to a certain extent. And you can make the Uber brand hotter by emphasizing that, or you could leverage the hotter smaller brands. How do you make that decision, and how does that conversation go within AOL?
Yeah, it's actually, we have that conversation all the time here. We had a big meeting, a 2-day offsite last week called Brand Camp, to kind of, which I think underscores the issue, right? Which is that we have, it's a little bit like Coca-Cola Company, right? Like there's Coke, and then there's all these other brands that Coke owns, right? And you might not even know that, you know, and I'm probably going to get one of these wrong, but like Tropicana, I think, might be owned by Coke or something like that. You might not know that the orange juice you're drinking is owned by a Coca-Cola Company, right? And I think that's true of a lot of the brands. I think a lot of people don't realize or think that TechCrunch is owned by AOL or Engadget's owned by AOL or Autoblog's owned by AOL. And I don't think it should matter very much any more than, you know, the average person should worry that much about, you know, the fact that ABC is owned by Disney or whatever. I mean, this is how big media companies work. They tend to own a lot of different properties. But I do think there is a sort of tension internally, which I think is actually good, is that we do think a lot about and discuss a lot is how much do we want to promote AOL as a brand, and how much do we want to make sure that we're properly highlighting these really strong smaller brands that we have, which are still, you know, pretty, I mean, I would say that TechCrunch is a huge global brand in its own right at this point. So it's tough. And I think that, I when I think about some of the stuff that I'm working on, you don't want to sort of be, you don't want to shy away from, you know, the AOL brand, but you also don't necessarily want to feel like you have to build stuff in service of it. And there's a lot of flexibility there. And I think, we've gotten a lot of Tim Armstrong, who's the CEO of AOL, of the overall company, was talking about this last week at Brand Camp. I mean, he really said, we're here to sort of enable the individual brands, and AOL is one of those brands, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
But TechCrunch isn't here to be TechCrunch by AOL. It's here to be TechCrunch. And Engadget's here to be Engadget by AOL. And the people that work in Engadget should focus on, should have the freedom to focus on making that brand great. They shouldn't have to worry about, you know, how does this, like, am I satisfying, AOL as a brand's needs. And I think that's been one of the things that's been good, is the recognition that the brands need to have that flexibility. But it's tough. And I think that at any big company, you kind of have these, these issues where you have to navigate these things.
That sounds like the right way to go, too, just intuitively. I've worked at companies where they didn't make that decision. They wanted to leverage the hotness of the sub-brands to boost the larger brand, and sometimes that can get awkward, and it doesn't serve the larger purpose of the company. Now, you have an interesting career in many dimensions, but one of them is that when you were a kid, none of the stuff you're doing right now existed. It wasn't a career choice to do what you're doing now. What did you want?
I think that's true for a lot of us.
That's true, absolutely. So what did you want to be when you grew up as a kid?
I think that the youngest job that I remember, or youngest age where I remember wanting to do something, I wanted to be an astronomer, probably for a long time. And then, you're going to think this is hilarious, but when I was in junior high, I really wanted to be a lobbyist.
Wow.
I don't know why exactly I got that into my head, but it seemed like I must have read something somewhere and about lobbyists being the sort of, you know, power behind the scenes kind of thing yeah. in the 80s. And it seemed really interesting to me. It's like I was really interested in policy and government. And it seemed like, wow, you could go to Washington. You didn't have to be – because I never felt like I had the personality type to be a politician. Like I never – you know, like to get up there and speak in front of people and be that sort of, you know, that sort of type A personality. But it seemed like, oh, you could be a lobbyist. That could be like a something that you do where you kind of help influence policy and you know. So I think maybe public policy would be maybe if I, you know, think about it now would probably be more what I was interested in than being a lobbyist per se. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, when I was in college, I actually wanted to be a professor. I have a master's in English. Like I thought I was going to go get a PhD and try to become a professor somewhere. that was until I was about 23, like that was my path.
Now you got your BA from Harvard and your master's from the University of Sussex.
Yeah.
I see where your career picked up and you were kind of in the public eye when you were writing for Red Herring. Did you do anything between college and Red Herring?
So after I got my master's, I finished my master's dissertation. I ended up getting a job at an advertising agency called Hal Reiney, which I don't know if people remember, there was this famous Morning in America campaign from when Reagan ran for re-election in 1984.
I remember.
Yeah, that was Hal Reiney. That was like his thing. And then he did all the advertising and sort of branding for the Saturn car. Yeah. Remember Saturn had that sort of very homey middle America vibe to it. And so that was sort of his trademark was this, you know, that he sort of understood that sort of homey, you know, morning in America, you know, Reagan America kind of thing.
John Artidi today and a studio engineer is telling me that the morning in America stuff was filmed here in Petaluma. Trivia. Yeah. It's always morning in Petaluma.
Yeah, it makes sense. I mean, he was based in San Francisco, and you know, so it makes sense that he would do something, you know, in the area. So I worked at his agency. I actually worked on the Saturn account, but not in creative. I worked on the media planning. I was an assistant media planner, and I had this job where I had to go through and figure out how much money we were going to spend with Southern newspapers and radio stations. And I worked with these car dealers in like Tennessee and Kentucky and things like that. And I was really bad at the job. I was very close to being fired when I quit. And then very just randomly got a job at Red Herring. Like I had a friend of mine who knew somebody that worked there. And this was during the first dot-com boom when I think they were paying like $5,000 referral bonus for people that if you brought somebody in to Red Herring. And so my friend's friend was like, give me every resume of every person you know. And he just brought them all in. And so someone there called me up and said, I have a job being Tony Perkins' ghostwriter. And Tony Perkins was the publisher and founder of Red Herring. And so I sort of ghostwrite his column and his speeches and things like that. And I went in, interviewed, and we had this like epic, like 2 hour long interview. I actually brought my master's dissertation as one of my writing samples because I had really almost nothing else to show him. And I walked out of the interview. I had a terrible interview. I bombed the interview. I walked out and I was like, I'm not getting that job. And the editorial recruiter called me. He's like, you didn't get the job. But I have a couple other jobs, one at the redherring.com, which Rafe Needleman, who is obviously like one of the most amazing people you can meet as the editor-in-chief, and Jason Ponton, who's another amazing person, as the editor of the magazine. And I interviewed with both and got offered a job at both. And they said, your pick. What do you want, the website or the magazine? And I said, I'll take the magazine.
Yeah, because I don't know who's going to read a website. Yeah,
no one's going to read a website. And I think it's also, there was a sort of like, well, a magazine I could, you know, give to my parents. And really impressed them with.
Yeah.
And so I worked at the magazine. And the funny thing is at Red Herring at the time, they were completely separate organizations. I mean, there was no crossover. The content from the magazine did not go on the website and vice versa. They had separate editorial staffs covering the same things. And the idea was that they were going to spin out the website and sell it, go public for like, you know, $5 billion or whatever crazy number people thought was possible back then. And, by 2001, the website had just completely, you know, I mean, the whole business was gone, basically.
Yeah, and for those too young to remember, Red Herring Magazine launched, I think, 93, something like that. And it was originally focused on venture capital, and sort of it sort of evolved into a business and technology of business kind of publication. And so you made a transition from that kind of magazine to founding Engadget, right?
Yeah, well, I did Gizmodo first.
Gizmodo was first. So that's quite a transition. Those are, you know, they're both sort of about technology, but completely different types of editorial content. And, of course, when Gizmodo launched, it was very, you know, that kind of thing was very new. It was unique, actually, in many ways. Now, how did you make that transition? Obviously, at some point along the way, you developed an obsession with gadgets and consumer electronics and technology. When did that strike you? When did you realize that you were just completely in love with technology?
Well, I'd always been really interested in consumer electronics in general. And my dad was a kind of an early adopter guy. We had a VCR in like 1979. He bought the first CD player that ever came out that was put out in the US, the Sony like CD 101 or whatever it was. And so, you know, he was sort of like, we had computers in the house really early, and he used to go to these sort of like homebrew computing club things and take me along with them when I was probably like 7 or 8, trying to use the Atari 400. And then I think we got an Atari 800. So it was always sort of, it's kind of present in my life. And my dad wasn't really he was sort of, you know, at heart, maybe more of like an AV enthusiast than a computer geek. But it was something that was kind of like always in our, you know, kind of present in our life. And I just remember like, you know, always kind of digging around in the garage and finding like weird random things from Radio Shack and trying to like build my own music recording studio out of just kind of random components I could find. So I was already pretty interested in it. And I think when I was at Red Herring, I was sort of more of the Wired-esque writer that they had on staff. So I was writing about stuff that was happening internationally, and I was writing about sort of like the bleeding edge technology stuff. I couldn't get them to write about Napster when it first hit. I was obsessed with Napster, and they said, well, there's no business model here, so we're not going to write about it. I said, that's not the point. The point is that it's this I didn't say disruptive, but it's like, you know, it's this big, because people didn't really use that word then. But it was like, you know, it was an interesting thing that was going to change the landscape for music and entertainment online. But anyway, so, you know, I was always pretty interested in it. But the way that Gizmodo got started was I had started blogging in probably summer of 2001, which was relatively early. I think that there was maybe like a few thousand bloggers at that point. And I just started a personal blog. I had lost my job at Red Herring and was really couldn't find, like, no one would give me a job. And a friend of mine who was an editor at Wired said, what you should do is you should start a blog and just sort of start writing and, you know, get your name out there and think of it as like a way to generate ideas that for pitches at the very least. And I was sort of like, well, write for free.
Yeah.
I'm used to getting paid, you know, like I'm used to getting paid $2 a word or whatever, you know, you would get paid back then for freelance writing. And he's like, no, just do it. And like, I think it'll lead to something really good. And so I did, I just started it. And I remember the first time, I think like Doc Searles was the first person to link to me, that was like, that I kind of knew, like that I had heard of, like I knew, I was like, Doc Searles, you know, Doc Searles is like an early pioneer in blogging, like an amazing guy, like super smart. And, I was really excited that happened. And, I was friends at the time with a guy named Nick Denton, who was chairman of a company called Moreover in San Francisco. And he and I had become friends in San Francisco, and he started blogging around the same time that I did. And he moved to New York. I think I actually helped convince him to move to New York because he was thinking about moving to, I think, LA. He was like, San Francisco's over. I'm going to move to, and this is like 2002. He's like, I'm going to move to LA or London or New York. And I was like, move to New York. It's like, it's great. You know, the city's great. Cause I'd moved there after I'd lost my job from Red Herring. I was actually supposed to move on September 11th, 2001. That was the day I was supposed to fly to New York. But I moved a few weeks later and, no job, no work. No one would hire me. I was like freelancing for, I think like NASDAQ International magazine was paying my rent. You know, what little work I could get from Wired and a few other places. And, you know, we were just like hanging out. This is like spring 2002 and we were talking about blogging. And he was asking me why I didn't post more to my regular blog. And I said, well, it's just tough because if I have to spend time writing, like I'm trying to, you know, I'll really focus on trying to find freelance work that pays rather than writing blog posts, which may or may not, you know, pay, but it's not, obviously not going to directly pay my rent. And he said, well, what if we created something and I paid you to do it and we just picked a topic and we thought, and we just kind of see what happens with it. And we talked about it and I was, you know, I knew it had to be something in tech and it seemed like if something was going to be able to maybe build a business out of it, that it could be gadgets. There was no actually dedicated gadget sites at the time, as far as I could tell. There's certainly no gadget blogs. We were really influenced by, I'm sure you know Glenn Fleischman.
Yes.
So he did an amazing blog called Wi-Fi Networking News. And
yes,
and it was like this, and it was kind of this revelation for me where you could do it. Obviously, you couldn't really start a magazine about Wi-Fi because you just couldn't justify the cost that would be involved. But with a blog, which cost basically zero to start, you could create a publication that was really focused and just kind of really zero in on it. And I mean, I just loved Wi-Fi Networking News. I just started, you know, just discovered Wi-Fi and gotten a router and a, you know, Wi-Fi card, one of those like Orinoco silver cards for my laptop and all that stuff. And I just was like, this is like amazing that you could just do this. Like, you could just say, I'm going to be the place where I tell you about everything that's going on in this world. And I was like, that's what I want to do with gadgets. I want to just be the place where you can see everything that's going on and everything that's interesting in that world. And, you know, it's going to be my filter because it's going to be me deciding what's interesting or what's, you know, what I think is worth, you know, kind of sharing. But that was sort of the point, was that with a blog, you were engaging with like a certain person's take or perspective on that world.
Yeah, absolutely. And for those listening, someone in the chat room is saying that Nick Denton sounds familiar. He, of course, is the founder of Gawker Media. I believe he founded it in 2002. And we are speaking with Peter Rojas, the founder of Engadget and Gizmodo and many other sites. And we're going to take a quick break and come back and talk more with Peter Rojas in just a sec. But first, I want to tell you about our sponsor today, which is SmartThings. SmartThings makes it easy to control your home with your smartphone. It's a home automation solution that's easy to use, but very, very powerful. Usually, most solutions are one or the other. This one is both. You can adjust the lights or temperature, keep track of whether your kids are home from school on time, and see if you remember to close the garage door. And you can do this from anywhere using an Android device or an iOS device. And it's easy to do, and it's even easy to buy. You can start with one of the three smart home security kits. And each kit contains a smart home hub and enough sensors, switches, and outlets to turn your home to a smart home in about 15 minutes. Just plug the SmartThings hub into your router and add sensors, switches, and outlets by following the instructions from the free and easy-to-use SmartThings app. Very simple to use. This is the router right here. Very, very nice. Looks like a regular router, but this actually plugs into your router, and you use this to control your devices. In addition to SmartThings' own sensors, you can add hundreds of other home automation devices from a variety of manufacturers like GE, Schlage, Honeywell, Eon, as well as the latest connected devices like the Nest thermostat, the Philips Hue, Wemo, Sonos, and more, all the major brands that you've heard about. Now, of course, it's easy to buy because they have three different kits. The first one's called the Smart Home Security Kit, and that's $329. And that includes a SmartThings hub, a SmartThings motion sensor, one presence sensor, and a SmartSense multi-sensors, which are multi-purpose sensors for doors, windows, and drawers that sense when things open and close, and they can even measure temperature, acceleration, vibration, things like that. You get three of those in the basic kit. Again, $329. The Smarter Home Security Kit is $479, and that adds an additional motion sensor, a smart power outlet, and a siren strobe alarm. I've got to have that one. And the top of the line is the Smartest Home Security Kit, which is $599. And that includes all the above, plus another presence sensor, a power outlet, and an outdoor light plug and control power outlet. So that's very, very powerful. And each of these kits is an affordable way to secure and automate your home with any of the without any of the contracts or monitoring fees or hidden charges associated with traditional home security companies or home automation companies. That's been the conundrum. You can either have the little tiny app that doesn't do much, or you can have the big, expensive, difficult to put together and maintain system. This has the best of both worlds. It gives you all the power of the more complicated systems without the costs or the difficulty. So to get started creating your smart home, visit smartthings.com/twit. You can save 10% off all the purchase of any home security kit by entering the code TWIT10 at checkout. You'll also get free shipping within the U.S. That's smartthings.com/twit. And remember to use the code TWIT10 at checkout. Well, Peter Rojas, now, you were an obsessive collector of records as a child, I understand.
Yeah.
Collected vinyl records, and you worked at a record store at some point in your life. Yeah. And then later on in your adult life, you founded a site called Record Label, spelled R-C-R-D, and then the next word is L-B-L. And was this startup an attempt to recapture your passion for vinyl records?
Well, unfortunately, we didn't really do anything on vinyl with that startup.
It's hard to download vinyl.
Yeah. If there was a way I could have figured that out, I would have. I mean, maybe with 3D printing.
But really, the curation and the cultivation of enthusiasm
yeah.
around music, it sounds like it was a similar kind of an endeavor.
Yeah. I was someone that, obviously, like, really into music. I played in bands, put out records, used to set up shows, and DJed at the radio stations. And I worked at a record store that was straight out of a High Fidelity. If anyone's seen that movie, like kind of exactly that those kind of people. I remember once my boss took me aside and said that I wasn't being sassy enough to the customers, and so which was kind of hard for me because I was sort of this meek kind of intimidated by everyone that both worked there and came in there.
Stop being so polite. You're too polite.
Yeah. And the funny thing about that record, I actually had to get a temp job to support the job at the record store because it paid so poorly, but. With Record Label, it was always a side project. I mean, I did it while I was at AOL. I started while I was at AOL the first time, got permission to do it and all that stuff. And then had this idea that I was going to sort of do it concurrently with Gadget, and then just got too busy with Gadget and, couldn't do both. Though Record Label continued on for, about 4 years after I left, 4.5 years after I left. But the idea there was that, I love music, and it was clear that, the music industry was really changing, and that, I didn't really believe in this. I wanted to see if you could build something that, rather than trying to fight the fact that people were going to share music or were interested in downloading music, for free, that you could sort of lean into that. And so what it was, and this is not something, it's this sort of the MP3, music blogging scene is sort of, not as vibrant as it was, say, 7 or 8 years ago when I started working on Record Label. But, at the time there were, lots of music blogs that were, bloggers who were curating, great music, hosting MP3 downloads on their sites. And it was basically all, I don't want to say illegal because that's sort of a very loaded word, but it was not authorized, right? Like, they weren't getting permission from the bands or the labels or whatever to do that. And I said, well, what if we tried to just do it legit, right? Where we work with the labels, work with the bands, and kind of give away their music, for them. But it's very curated. We work with only, bands or that, only bands or artists that we think are really great. And it kind of evolved into like a almost like a daily candy for music, where we had a daily newsletter where we gave away one great track every day. I think it was every weekday. And we got the lists up to maybe like 300, 350,000 subscribers. But it was just, with the recession and everything, we launched in fall of 2007. And then with the economic downturn the next year, it just was pretty difficult to find those sort of lifestyle marketing dollars that wanted to support a venture like that. And, it's, it was a business that maybe wasn't it wasn't meant to make it, but I had a lot of fun working on it. Got to meet a lot of great, you know, artists. Got to work with a lot of really great people, and you know, kind of myself discovered a lot of great music through it. So if nothing else, like for me, there was that you know, that element to it.
I see. Well, now when you launched Gizmodo, you did it out of your passion for technology, and also because there was nothing else like it. You wanted to pursue that type of content and so on. And then the money came. You were able to hire a bunch of people for all of these sites that you launched, Engadget.
Well, eventually with Engadget, yeah. But with Gizmodo, I mean, the reason that the biggest reason why I left Gizmodo to do Engadget was that Nick's sort of vision for, because when I started Gizmodo, there was no Gawker Media. And then he started Gawker, and he had this idea that, you know, Gizmodo was now kind of going to be part of this bigger blog network, which I didn't have a problem with. But his model was to have maybe like, you know, 6 to 10 blogs, each with an individual editor posting, kind of working half time. And I just felt like that we were onto something big that we could go and do, you know, we could do something major with. And, you know, I really wanted to be able to sort of take on CNET and become maybe a post, kind of this idea that we could have a team of bloggers posting 24/7 and sort of being very ambitious in what we wanted to do. And, you know, I linked up with Jason Calcanis and Brian Albee, who were starting to kick off Weblogs Inc., and they convinced me to join up with them. And, you know, I finally had sort of, you know, I wouldn't say a lot more resources because I didn't, but I had the sort of the runway. I don't want to say runway because that implies a lot of cash also, but I guess I kind of had the latitude to take things in that direction, to kind of work against that vision. And, you know, eventually we're able to get there. I mean, I think being acquired by AOL in 2005 really got us there. I mean, it meant that I could hire people full time and give them benefits and have travel budgets and be able to sort of take on the, you know, the big guys in a way that I always wanted to.
And of course, this is advertiser supported content, which, it, you know, the world of advertising is constantly shifting and changing, and the costs for advertising, the amount of money that can be made from advertising is always in flux. And so it's a very different world now than it was when you started out or when you started Engadget. It's in many ways a tougher world. What advice would you give a person, a young Peter Rojas, who's coming into the world to build a blog or to build a site, to build an enthusiastic site, who really is passionate about a subject matter but wants to make a living at it and maybe build a business around it, what advice would you give them?
Well, I think you're right that it is tough. I mean, it's funny because it was tough when I started in that there was no Google AdSense, and a lot of advertisers didn't want to be on blogs because they either didn't know what that was, or when they just thought it was, you know, some crazy person ranting, which, to be honest, was probably maybe 50% of blogs at the time anyway. I think that the challenges now are that, you know, that you have to be at a much bigger scale in terms of traffic to be able to get the attention of advertisers now. It's kind of, I don't want to say the opposite problem, but it's now that, you know, it used to be that getting a few 100,000 visitors a month was maybe enough to be able to get you, the interest of advertisers, and now it's probably more like a few million visitors a month at minimum. I mean, it really depends on what you're trying to do, but I would say that if you want to, I think the first thing is that, and actually I get a lot of, you know, young bloggers who email me for advice all the time, and I'm always happy to you know, to help people out. And the first thing I say is, if you're going to do a blog, you have to make sure that you're really passionate about the subject matter, because there are going to be days where you're miserable and you don't want to do it. And you have to have something that you can sort of draw on to help get you through it. And there definitely were days, a lot of days. And I mean, with Gizmodo and Engadget, I worked 7 days a week for years, you know, where I was not happy or really exhausted from it. And it was just a sort of, you know, desire to keep, you know, growing it and moving it forward that you know, kept me motivated. So I think that you have to have that at first. Like, I sometimes get people that say, well, I think Gadgets, you know, and I don't get this very much anymore, but people would be like, well, I think Gadgets, you know, it's clearly like a popular category and I think I can do something with it, but But then, you know, you can sort of, when you ask them, it's like they're not really that excited or interested in it. So you have to have that passion right off the bat. I think the other thing is that I think it has to have focus. I think that if you're going to start a general technology blog now, that unless you're going to have a lot of people to work on it and the resources to go head to head with, you know, Engadget and The Verge and TechCrunch and the other sites that are out there, it's going to be tough. And so a lot of the sites that I think that have kind of cropped up in the last few years that have been really successful have been very focused. Like a lot of the sites that are focused on Android, for example, have done really, really well. And that's because they've kind of said, we're not going to be about everything. We're just going to be about this one area and we're going to really focus in. I think one of the other things to, and again, this is specific to maybe gadgets, but maybe is something that could be applied across the board, is that, you know, going back 10 years ago, 12 years ago, gadgets was sort of a niche. People didn't really necessarily divide themselves up. I guess there were sort of Apple fanboys and maybe Microsoft fanboys, but now it's the level of granularity to fanboyism is pretty intense. And, you know, I think that starting those general sites is tough, you know, because I think people like are maybe passionate about like specific things. Like they might be just passionate about phones or just passionate about Windows Phone or just passionate about some, you know, narrow niche of the market. And so I always encourage people to kind of like, you know, drill down and try to find like if you can find a specific niche that you can be the most authoritative voice in, like find that. Don't try to, the more general you are, the harder it is to find an audience.
That's absolutely true. As somebody who's always blogged the most general technology blog there is, I always tell people don't do what I did. You should really specialize, find out what your passion is. And I find a lot of bloggers go into it thinking, I want to do this for a living. I want to make money. I want to build a business. So what should I write about? And if that's the thinking,
yeah,
then you've got to reverse that. You have to be willing to do it for free. And if you're so passionate about it that you would do it for nothing and still put a lot of time into it, then you probably have the passion that will enable you to succeed in that, depending on
I mean, if you just want to blog and make money, just go to like Google AdSense, find out what the biggest keyword payouts are, right? and blog about like mesothelioma or whatever, you know, is paying out the most. And cynically, like I've seen people do that, right? Like where they just sort of figure out what are the biggest, you know, what keywords, what topics pay out the most, right? In Google AdSense or whatever, you know, kind of ads. I think you got to like be really excited about what you do. And I think you can also really tell as a reader when somebody is not that excited about or is maybe has the wrong motivations. And I certainly don't think that, you know, we should have litmus tests for journalists and things like that. And I know that as, you know, when I was at Red Herring, I would be assigned stories and to write about things I wasn't necessarily very interested in. I tried to do the best I could. But I think with a blog, because the personality and the voice are so integral to the experience, that you really want to, you know, if you're going to try to build a business around it, like, you know, you got to focus on that passion and that enthusiasm. And if you don't have it, you know, there's a lot of other things you can do to make a living. It's not like, you know, and in fact, probably better ways to make a living than starting a blog.
I'm sure there are. Now, you're still very young. You're not even 40 yet. Do you envision launching more sites, blogs, content sites in your future sometime? What do you think?
Well, I joke on my Twitter bio that please don't let me start another gadget site. You know, I'm not sure that I want to do that again. I think part of it is that I think it's just a different world now. And I think that you know, when I look at the ways in which you have to, if I look at the sites that have been the most successful in the past few years, and not just tech sites, but just across the board online, like things like BuzzFeed and Upworthy and kind of those things, it's about kind of socially driven viral content. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. And like, I enjoy, you know, BuzzFeed just like anybody else. But I think it's you have to kind of play that game if you want to, you know, scale or build a big site now. And, you know, while I've helped some of, you know, I'm helping the brands here kind of, you know, understand and navigate that world, I'm not sure I would necessarily want to go and build a new brand just, you know, after I leave AOL, like to go and do, you know, go build a new kind of another gadget site. I'm not saying I'll never do one, but, kind of feels like, And this is kind of what is a little bit scary, is that I don't know what I'm going to do, you know, after this. Like, I've certainly thought about it a little bit, but it'll be the first time in basically since I finished grad school that I'll kind of have that I won't know what that next thing is going to be. Because I always kind of, like, when I was doing Gizmodo, you know, when I quit Gizmodo, like, I started Engadget the next day, and then Engadget was bought, and then I did Record Label, and then I did Gadget, and then Gadget was bought, and, you know, so it's like I've never had, like, a moment, I've never had time where I haven't had, like, that next thing ready to go. And I'm trying to, my plan right now is to not have a next, not really focus on finding the next thing, maybe letting it find me.
Interesting. Well, you're very successful at what you're doing now. And of course, I'm probably not alone in hoping that you do launch new sites in the future and to apply everything you've learned in your career to building a new kick-ass site. And I also think, speaking of kicking ass, I think you'd be a kick-ass lobbyist for the electronics industry.
You know, it's funny, like, maybe I should get down there and try to lobby for some of this net neutrality stuff, which I think is, you know, such a huge issue. And, you know, before we go, you know, Mike, I want to point out that you're one of the first sources that, you know, like, I used to link to you with Gizmodo and then Engadget. I think I had like 25 bookmarks. This is before RSS readers were really a thing. And what was the site you were doing? It was like around 2000. Yes, the raw feed. So the raw feed was one of my 2 dozen bookmarks. I checked every single day, and I basically would just link to whatever you wrote.
I appreciate that. I got that weird feeling when somebody that's one of your 20 bookmarks is linking to you. It's kind of freaked me out as well. So I appreciate that. Thank you so much. And we are talking here, Triangulation, talking to Peter Rojas, the founder of Gizmodo, Engadget, Joystick, Record Label, GDGT, and the current vice president of strategy for the AOL brand group. Peter Rojas, thank you so much for joining us on Triangulation. Really appreciate
it. Thanks so much for having me.
All right. Thanks again. We do Triangulation Mondays at 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern, normally hosted by Leo Laporte, of course. You can watch the show live, and we appreciate that because you can engage in the chat room and ask questions that we can ask our guests. And you can subscribe to the show by going to the site. You can subscribe on iTunes or wherever podcasts are available. And, of course, you can watch, listen, or download all Triangulation episodes ever recorded at twit.tv/TRI. Thank you all, and thank you, Peter Rojas. We'll see you next time on Triangulation.